You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for August 8th, 2014. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the War on White People Central Command. It's the Professional Left with Drift Class and Blue Gal. Yeah.
Drift Class, this guy Mo Brooks is a representative of Alabama.
Yes, he is.
An elected representative to the United States Congress.
He is. He is.
And he says, you know, this immigration thing's a war on whites.
Uh-huh.
Did you know that he was named one of the GOP's young guns?
Young guns! Young guns! He's one of
and
the
he's
young
56.
Guns. Yeah, well, that's compared to...
Compared to John McCain.
The octogenarians. Yeah, he's a young gun, sure. Grandpa Young Gun!
I mean, that's only 5 years older than I am, but I would never call myself Young Gun!
Young Guns. Well, I would also never inveigh against the terrible war on white people.
White people? Well, you're not from Alabama, let me tell you.
No, I'm not.
I lived in Alabama for 14 years.
Yeah.
And aggrieved whiteness is far and away.
Is in the war.
Present. Mm-hmm. Unless, you know what really battles racism more than anything else in the South is
before, but yeah.
Chambers of Commerce.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Is it going to affect tourism if we hate on the black people?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So big cities that want to attract not just tourists, but more specifically convention dollars, are really careful to have inclusivity rallies and declarations by the city council of Racial Equality Week and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it gets to be a problem if your city is seen as being
a racist pest hole.
Racist pest hole of white aggrieved congressmen like Mo.
Well, then there you go. You know what cures Mo Brooks is Mo money. Because that almighty dollar.
Mo money.
When it's used for good. Like contributing to a podcast, for example, or
like contribute. Thank you for everyone that contributes to our podcast. Oh my goodness, you guys are so generous and supportive of our work. And if this podcast means something to you, we appreciate you paying for the podcast because that's what you do. Rand Paul is now a hashtag, as in ran away.
Yes,
and
yes,
I
he
love
is.
That. You did some great photoshops of Rand Paul running away from stuff.
Yeah, I have tried to appropriate the Oprah meme.
Yes, run Oprah run if you want to see that on Tumblr.
Oprah Winfrey running away from things. Rand Paul running away from things. Rand Paul running away from things.
He lied to Greta Van Susteren last night and saying that he had a scheduled meeting to attend. A scheduled interview he had to get to right away, which Lawrence O'Donnell said, you know, that's a smart staffer who pulls him up and makes him run away from those dreams.
Yeah, that's a good staffer. Yeah,
that's a good staffer. No question about it.
Fake a seizure, hit the fire alarm.
But here's what I want to know. Since when do you go to a scheduled interview with a half-open beer and a mouthful of hamburger?
Yeah. Well, and since when do you take one bite, as Stephanie Miller has said? Since when does any real American take one bite of a hamburger, drop it, and run away?
Yep.
No, that doesn't happen. And you know, and this has been hashed over 5 or 6 dozen times, but if you're running for president, why the hell are you sitting down with Steve King?
Honestly.
Yeah, I mean, you're in Iowa. You're running in Iowa.
You have to.
You have to.
Because because you're a Republican, you have to.
You're a Republican in Iowa, and Steve King.
That's a problem. That's the problem.
Yep.
And until they fix their calendar to where they are not starting in Iowa, I know that's like pulling three molars, and it's going to be really hard. But until they move the filter that filters out their candidates away from,
Steve King.
Let's face it, no offense, but a state that is 94% white.
Yeah.
Until they do that, they are behind.
I have two siblings who were both born in Iowa.
Yeah.
I was raised for several years in Iowa. I know it very well. I had grandparents live in Iowa. Beautiful cities in town. But once you get the hell away from The university centers, the college centers.
Well, this is true of a lot of states, actually. This is true of Illinois, Southern Illinois as well.
And it used to be sort of, as in my memory, it was very much like the way Kansas used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You trended Republican, but you weren't assholes about it. You weren't antediluvian. You know, you weren't dark age lunatics, and that they've become that. And I don't see having them as their primary, having it in Iowa as a problem. I see it as a solution. I love the idea that the Republicans have to embrace their inner Klansmen publicly and early.
Well, yeah, as a Democrat, I agree with you. Yeah. But I'm speaking just from the standpoint of how do we help? Because I still feel that a strong two-party system is good for this country.
I agree.
It's just that one of them has gone completely psychotic.
Yes.
And that's not good. And how do you fix that? And unfortunately, we have to, I think... The woman, it was in Kansas, who wrote at Crooks and Liars about she is now voting in Republican primaries.
Yeah.
In Kansas to get the sane person on the ballot because whoever the Republican candidate is for a lot of statewide offices is going to be the winner.
Well, and I think the problem, as we often say on here, I'll put it a different way. America, Blue Gal, America is a bad parent.
Yeah. Yeah.
America is a bad parent. In the following sense, America has two kids, and one kid is a violent, psychotic, antisocial lunatic who sets fire to the neighbor's house and smashes the car and kills animals and is just...
And is both subliminally and overtly racist.
Yes. Just trashes the joint. Mm-hmm. Uncontrollable, berserk, beyond delinquent. The other one gets C's in school. And occasionally doesn't do their chores and is lazy and sometimes lies about little things. The problem is that...
And sometimes lies about big things and has friends on Wall Street that give them drugs.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. I mean...
But you can... There's a difference between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And every time the antisocial Republican child burns down a building, Mom and Dad America punishes both kids.
Yeah.
And every time... antisocial lunatic Republican kid smashes a car, starts a war, or bankrupts the treasury. Or,
yeah, but the other kid got a C.
Mom Chuck Todd and Dad David Gregory punish both children. And the secret is the antisocial lunatic kid loves it when the other kid gets punished. So he goes, he sees it as in his absolute, to his absolute benefit to be as completely nuts as possible, because he knows mom and dad are going to blame everybody for it.
Yep.
We're going to spread the blame around. And the two-party system is never going to be fixed as long as both parties are equally punished for the travesties of one of them. And as long as our media, hello Chuck Todd, hello David Gregory, hello half the people at MSNBC and everybody on Fox News, virtually everyone on the mainstream media, as long as it is in your financial and professional interest to continue to lie about the differences between the two parties, the Republican Party is never going to recover, because it doesn't have to. Because every time they rob a bank, you and I go to jail, Blue Gal. And that's absurd and ridiculous. And it's such an open secret about how absurd it is. It's so clearly a joke at this point in Washington that isn't it funny how we tell a bunch of rubes out there these lies every week and get away with it, and they pay us a shitload of money. Isn't that awesome? That's what's broken. The Republican Party is secondary. The obsessive both-siderism, in my estimation, has always been the primary problem.
I want to share a dialogue you and I had this week when Hillary Clinton was on the Stephen Colbert show.
Yeah.
And she came out and everyone cheered. And I have to admit, I put my hands together clapping and said, oh, you know what? Dorfglass, I don't hate her anymore. Uh-huh. And you said, I don't hate her yet.
Yep. Well,
and I thought, you know, there is a long time between now and Election Day 2016.
Yeah.
When she can give us a reason to hate her.
Oh, yeah. Well, and she is trailing behind her a whole bunch of baggage.
Yeah.
Siding with a whole lot of policies that I profoundly disagree with, that most Democrats, most liberals, certainly most liberals I know, really disagree with.
Yeah.
But we find ourselves, as we always do in every election since the beginning of time, with two imperfect choices.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, we haven't even entered the primary season yet, so we don't know what those choices are. But I am deeply uncomfortable with Hillary's foreign policy proclivities. I am very uncomfortable with her and her family's close attachments to Wall Street.
Yeah, I'm not sure what her foreign policy proclivities are anymore, and I want to hear more about that.
I'd like to hear more about them. I would like to hear her admit she's
wrong. How has she evolved? I hope that she will try to convince me that she has.
But your husband just gave the eulogy for Richard Mellon Scaife.
Right, and he and Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
Gave money to your Senate campaign in New York.
And I want to hear...
How chummy is that?
I want to hear how that's not a problem.
Right.
I want to hear somebody ask that question.
Rupert Murdoch being a donor to your campaign, how is that not a problem? Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about something called executive function this week. This is tied to our back to school activities, which take over this house in late August.
Yes.
And in fact, I was saying to you last night, somebody on the TV was saying, you know, bring your back to school shopping to our store. And they made it sound like, it was Cyber Monday. That's what it was.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, Walmart. It was a Walmart commercial, which we never shop at Walmart. But Walmart commercial saying you could order stuff online for back to school for Cyber Monday. And you said to me, I thought Cyber Monday was a Christmas thing. And I said to you, and this is absolutely true, I spend as much money, I lay out as much cash getting three kids ready for school as I do at Christmas.
Yep.
So
it's a thing.
And you have the advantage at Christmas time of having a basement with a tree, artificial tree and ornaments, and people send you stuff and so forth. But back to school is just a huge outlay of cash.
Every year.
But we got a magazine in the mail that was talking about, because we have special needs children, executive function.
Was it a special needs magazine?
No, it wasn't. Well, you can call it a special. It was Mensa Monthly, which is a special needs magazine.
It is. Let's not deny that that isn't a substantial amount of overlap between.
Overlap in the spectrum and intelligence. Yeah. And we say that because we're both Mensa members. So.
High up on the spectrum there.
High up on the spectrum, high functioning people on the autism, Asperger's spectrum.
Yes, we are.
ADD, OCD, you name it.
Yeah.
in fact, I think you and I have it just, your OCD and my ADD are just about balanced.
Just about balanced off, yeah.
Yeah, I don't hate you when you tell me to hand you my dinner plate.
Right.
I can't find it. I don't know what I did with my dinner plate.
but it's a weirdo household, but we're a happy weirdo household.
We're a happy weirdo household. But this article on executive function, I really made me think that there's a lot to connect. It's a good theme on which to hang the Congress and back to school and the president and politics and all kinds of things. So this is the theme for our show today. And I'm going to explain what executive function is.
Please explain what executive
function is. Because kids that are on the autism spectrum, but also in general, this is a term that's used in occupational therapy for lots of different people with special needs. Executive function is the ability to start a project and finish it, or to perform a life function like paying a bill on time, or showing up for work on time, or getting your homework turned in, grocery shopping. Finding out if a grocery store delivers, that's actually on the test for executive function that a lot of occupational therapists use. They want the person they are testing, they ask them, we want you to find a grocery store within that will deliver to your house. So it has to be close to your house. Find out if they deliver and then let me know.
Mm-hmm.
And those steps, if the amount of brain power and the amount of organization it takes to take those steps of even just asking Siri, is there a grocery store nearby that delivers?
Yeah.
You know, that takes executive function to do that. And the example that I found on a learning disability website pointed out children that have executive function problems often need to be taught that homework is not done until your homework is in its folder. The folder is in your backpack and your backpack is in the backpack box to get in the car in the morning.
Right.
And your backpack gets out of the car and gets into your classroom, and then the folder comes out of your backpack and your homework's turned in. I mean, those steps for a child that has impaired executive function, very often getting the actual paper finished isn't the problem.
Right.
It's getting it into the folder and thinking, now I have to make sure this gets to where it needs to go and gets turned in.
Yep.
And
believe it or
that
not,
is a problem for children with attention deficit disorders, with hyperactivity disorders, with autism disorders. It's also a problem for children who live in poverty and live in violent societies.
Absolutely. Yep.
And so when we start beating up on teachers and teachers unions, and we're dealing with the whole host of issues that a child that walks into their classroom has to deal with, and so often in the public school system, it's poverty. A parent, first of all, one of the problems we have in the school systems with children that have executive function disorder is their parents also have executive function disorder. So the house is not organized for homework. There is no place to put your backpack when you're done. And sometimes it just requires total retraining of everybody. And that's not something that the school districts have the resources to do. And if the parent is poor, has to worry about where the next meal is coming from, doesn't know what shift they're working tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is the problem with Walmart workers is just, I don't know how anyone
chaos
is a parent and works at Walmart where you don't know what your shift is.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you don't know how many hours you're going to work next
week.
And
so you can't schedule anything.
You can't schedule doctor's appointments. You can't schedule teacher's conferences. You can't schedule your life. And that is, that impairs executive function. So we're going to talk about how that we just talked about how that affects back to school. And I do want to you to mention, because one of our children attends what they call a charter school.
Uh-huh.
And I know that Campbell Brown has been making the rounds talking about her union busting ideas for improving education.
Yeah. You know who her husband is, by the way?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's what's his?
Dan Senior.
Dan Senior. Senior.
Who was
yes.
the Baghdad Bob of the Bush administration.
Honestly.
One of the most profligate professional liars that the George Bush administration ever hired to lie about Iraq. And of course, he hasn't been without work since because he's good at his job.
But I did want to explain why we send our child to this charter school. First of all, this school is a part of the district.
Yeah.
It was not set up to fix a problem that a mayor or a board of education had with the school system.
Exactly.
The teachers that teach there are union teachers. The it is in the middle of a very low income black neighborhood. Our children are bused there, and it is run. The funding for the part of the school that is the charter is from a single family foundation that is just doing this one school as a gift to the community. It is not a political broad sweep of we want to make sure that, you know, kids are learning about Jesus kind of thing.
Right.
But what they demand at this particular school is parental involvement and a slightly longer school year.
Yeah.
And that's it in terms of the differences between that school and the you can get kicked out if you're not an involved parent at this school. But the interesting thing is you have to fill out paperwork to get your child into this charter school, which means you're already an involved parent. They've already filtered out that issue. So you said we also have a magnet school in our community,
uh-huh.
which is a technology school that we would like when our youngest child is in going into middle school for her to go to this place. And you said that whether she gets in or not, you're just going to send her there because she can be a concealed carry student.
Yeah. Registration. I don't need to register a goddamn thing. I'm an American. I'm free. I have freedoms. I have freedoms. I'm a concealed carry student. I get to walk in and do whatever I want. Register? What is this? Communist Russia? And we'll see how long that lasts.
We'll see how long. You know, I want to connect executive function to the Republican Congress.
Yeah.
Except in some respects, I don't think it's an executive function problem. I think it's a conscious effort to ruin government for everyone.
Well, the effect. This is a Mr. Brother Charlie Pierce wrote a very nice article post on the shell shock presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And which the only thing I could add to it in the comment section was taking a post of mine from 4 years ago, which said essentially the same thing, and putting it in the comment section. But it is not the executive function of the Republican Party is not impaired.
Mm-hmm.
The it is the impairment.
Yes.
Believe me, I understand this. I am a member of the long-term un- and underemployed. And it is easy after you have failed, after you've been hit over and over and over again in the face, to just say, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stop doing this. It's easy once Lucy pulls the football away from you for the 100th time to just give up on planning for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no point in it, because clearly, and that's where you end up having a breakdown in that function of your executive branch of the government, which is they just throw up their hands going, well, everything is broken now and there's nothing we can do to fix it. And we don't have a plan for that. So you end up with something like, I don't think the Republican Party qualifies as, I'm getting a little lost myself.
Well, we want to connect executive function to Obama and the GOP Congress.
Yes.
And what I think you're saying is that the GOP Congress is intentionally traumatizing the political process.
Yes.
To the point where Obama loses executive function. He cannot carry out a plan to do anything, because no matter what he does, they will vote against their own bills.
Right.
In order to stymie progress.
And Charlie Pierce draws a very good parallel to being shell shocked, to World War One, the 100th anniversary of World War One, saying it impairs that kind of sustained, completely overwhelming trauma gets into your imagination. It gets into your thought processes. It infects the way you see the world, and it changes your perception of what is impossible and what isn't. And you start just dealing with the world, you shut off from the world, you shut down from the world, because it's impossible for you to live there. You're forced into literally an impossible situation. Your nervous system is not built to take this kind of punishment. And so what the GOP has done is put a big, big steel drum on Obama's head and pounded it on it for the last 6 years. And at some point in the last 6 years, he stopped saying, please stop doing that. And now he's trying over the cacophony of the this was something he was never prepared for. Prepared for a party, a political party, United States political party, deliberately sabotaging their own country just to hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And doing it over and over and over and over again. And the media just jerking off to it.
Yeah.
And saying, what are you going to do? It's just a fact of nature. It's just one of those things. It's both sides. And the media going along with making the public hate Washington because one of the two parties there is poisoning our capacity to govern ourselves. And as I said in a post many years ago, he's a process guy. He believes in finding middle ground. He believes in working through. He believes in, above all, that if you're just calm and reasonable, eventually you can find a way to work through things. And it never occurred to him, which is a complete failure on his part, that his partner in peace, his partner in government, would be out to destroy him from day one and would absolutely have no problem, as you said, voting against their own bills, filibustering their own ideas, shutting the government down, because they know that no matter how badly they fuck things up or burn things down, their voters will keep putting them back into office, and the media will still keep going, what are you going to do? Maybe it's a failure of leadership. Maybe it's extremes on both sides. And there isn't a way to deal with that. The last time this has happened, seriously, the last time this sort of thing happened, we had to roll the Union Army into the South and put them down. I mean, imagine what the Union would have looked like if the South had stayed in the Congress and turned their guns on the Federals.
Yeah.
Because that's where we're at now. We have a secessionist, seditionist party who openly wants to destroy the federal government of the United States. And they just sit in Congress laughing about it because they can fuck everything up. And they have enough.
Well, and because they have, like you said, a willing media.
Yep.
And also a constituency that is so wrapped up in the lies that they're told by the right-wing media that they'll do without health insurance to get that Obama.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of shooting themselves in the foot, literally and figuratively, that voters in the South are willing to go through to punish the black president.
Mm-hmm.
Is, to me, I'm going to use the word astonishing.
Yeah.
I know I say that word too much, but it does astonish me that people would go without health insurance because that Obama.
Mm-hmm. Can I read you one little piece from Charlie Pierce?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And then we're going to stop because this is a short podcast this week.
Yeah, we've got to go.
We got to go.
We've got a mission.
We've got kids coming back.
Yeah. This little piece from Charlie Pierce is from the Shell Shock presidency, and it's a longer piece. But for all the fervor of his followers and for all the tearful wonder that greeted the election of the nation's first African-American chief executive, this president believed in nothing more than he believed in the power of cool reason. He believed that his good faith would be answered in kind. His belief that his good faith would be answered in kind was damn near indomitable. And in my opinion, that was his downfall. I don't believe it ever occurred to him that reason would be met with unreason, that logic would be met with illogic, and that facts would be met with fantasy. I don't believe it ever fully occurred to him that action on crisis, on the crisis of climate change, would be met not with a debate over the best way to limit carbon emissions while not demolishing the economy, but with a fervent denial that the crisis even exists. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it ever fully occurred to him that adopting a healthcare reform that, at the very least, had gestated on the Republican side of things, would be recast for the masses as one step short of the Nuremberg laws. Yeah. It didn't occur to him that the people who are dealing with are evil. Yeah. And that is a huge blind spot. And he never got over it. Now, I think the Republicans are going to take the Senate.
Mm.
And I think they're going to keep the House. And I think for the last 2 years, it's going to be high noon.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama is going to be Gary Cooper.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's going to have to be out there all by himself. The Republicans are going to put up one bill after another, after another, after another, just to make him look bad, just to humiliate him. The Save America's Children from Communism bill.
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
Why Can't Mothers Get a Better Deal bill. The Don't You Love America, You Fucking Kenyan Asshole bill. And they're just going to keep running that at him over and over again. He's going to have to veto everything they do. And that's going to be the last 2 years of his presidency, is vetoing a secessionist
and executive ordering whatever he can
while
being impeached for it, likely
whatever blows up or falls apart or anything bad that happens. You know, if a comet clips the moon and the mm-hmm. debris is falling towards the earth, the Republican Party will hold him hostage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll let you save America from a devastating meteor strike if you approve the Keystone Pipeline.
And I'm crying at the same time.
Because
they do that.
Because they would. They absolutely would. They would absolutely put willing to see this country burn to the ground as long as they get to take him to hell with them.
Yeah.
And it is an and he, Roosevelt, at least had the good sense to understand that the people.
I want you to hate me.
Yeah. I welcome
your hatred.
You point at the bankers and say, they hate me. I welcome their hatred. Obama never had the presence of mind or advisors around him, or really the character.
He didn't have that kind of.
He's not built that way.
Yeah, we talked about how he's a process guy. We've talked about that many times. The process falls apart. Being a process guy falls apart when someone is hog tying everything you do.
Yeah. Well, when they're willing to take a sledgehammer to the process itself,
mm-hmm.
to destroy any ability to even discuss anything,
mm-hmm.
to even have a conversation about anything. And when the press just says, well, you know, you got to get 60 votes in the Senate, as if that's normal.
As if that's normal.
And as long as you have Chuck Todd and David Gregory covering the escape of the Republican Party, covering up their arson with, well, you know, both sides are really guilty of this, frankly. Nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change because it doesn't have to. Republicans are very happy with the system they have. They wreck the country, then they run on the country being broken. The press is happy because they get to say nothing, do nothing, and keep their fat salaries and fiddle while Rome burns, because none of this affects them. Not a goddamn bit of this. The stock market is at 16,000. Their defense stocks are doing great. Their energy stocks are doing great.
They don't have to pay any taxes.
They don't have to pay a goddamn thing. So the people who run your media and the people who work for them, who you see on camera, don't give a shit about this. This doesn't affect them in any way. It's a show. It's to keep the rubes mixed up and angry. But you can see when something really bad happens, how they suddenly they all get serious about it. You know, a real crisis when they all align on the same side. And that'll happen 4 or 5 times between now and 2016. But for the most part, everybody except the liberals are perfectly happy with the way the system works. And mm-hmm. the people in the middle are perfectly content with being, frankly, lazy.
Well, and this affects all of us. This affects every citizen of this country
mm-hmm.
because our ability to plan ahead, for retirement, for it, the income distribution in this country is so skewed toward the wealthy that 99% of us cannot plan next year.
Right. Yep.
So we are paralyzed. And that is affecting economic growth in this country, which is what that Standard & Poor's report that Lawrence O'Donnell was talking about this week pointed out so unemotionally and clearly, which is the rich people really are hurting themselves.
They are.
By hampering any ability to improve things, to make the world a better place, to make this country a better place. Mm-hmm. Is that a good place to end?
Well, I would just say that I remember a quote by William Gibson, the guy who wrote Neuromancer, and he helped create cyberpunk, the cyberpunk genre, said something to the effect in one of his books that we don't have change anymore like our grandparents had change.
Yeah.
They could sort of look at the future 20, 30, 40 years out and plan.
And yes, right.
10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, here's what my salary will probably be. I'll have a union job. I'll be able to retire at 55 or 62. I need X amount of dollars to send my kids to school and pay a mortgage. I can plan for the future.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that. We have risk management.
Yeah.
And we are all shell-shocked now. We are all coping with the fact that there's a large, destructive, stomping monster jumping up and down in our country who doesn't want us to be calm and rational anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Hartman,
and face a problem and fix it.
Yeah, and Tom
together.
Hartman does a good riff on this every so often. That go back to the 70s, we were a net creditor nation. Now we're a net debtor nation. We had robust unions. Now we have no unions. We had a relatively rising tide of salaries. Wealth was being increased at pretty much every level. What happened? Conservatives took over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite a perfect calendar moment, but pretty much once the conservative argument became the template for all debate in this country, once it was, well, yeah, but what about the tax cuts?
Yes.
How are we going to cut taxes more? How will this plan of yours result in decreasing taxes for rich people? And that became the standard for doing anything in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We became a debtor nation. We became a belligerent, ignorant nation. Our educational standards went down. Our workplace standards went down. Our productivity went way the hell up. But all that wealth went into the hands of a very, very few people. That's what conservatism has done for this country for the last 30 or 40 years. And
they've done a very good job of covering that up for the pig people.
And if we could relax and take a breath and have a calm public discussion about the facts of the case, we could come up with a way to undo the damage. But half of our media, two-thirds of our media, three-quarters of our media, and half of our political class are devoted to keeping up the clamor and the chaos and the noise that prevent that conversation from happening. And that's
let's work on that, Driftglass.
Let's
work on making that conversation happen.
Yeah, every week, shall we? Let's try for every week.
Every week. And just like every week, we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Kashmir. C-A-S-I-M-I-R. Kashmir. He is very fierce, and he can bite a rope. You'll see him biting the rope on his scratching post in this wonderful picture. He will defend his empire. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at that address, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise.
So, Blue Gal, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, the Internet Kitties have come up with a new cat toy. It looks like Rand Paul, and your cat can chase it all over Iowa.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2014, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, this week we have a letter from our friend Kevin Holtzinger, who writes us from time to time. By the way, he sent me a trailer for the Hot Tub Time Machine 2, which is coming out at Christmas,
which I thought
I wouldn't like.
Yeah, you would think that would not be awesome.
That's really a bad idea, right?
Yeah.
Especially since John Cusack isn't apparently in it.
Right.
But it looks pretty funny. So we'll give it a chance.
You never know.
You never know. Also, Kevin Holzinger is the one who told me this is something you will not believe. Uh-huh. Guess what's going to be made into a movie? It's going to star Will Ferrell.
Uh-huh. That tells me nothing.
Key and Peele are writing the script.
Is it based on a thing?
It's based on, you're not going to believe this, Manimal. They're going to make Manimal. They're going to make Manimal into a movie.
Wow.
I never missed a Manimal. You know that, right?
All three of them, right? You were the one.
All four or five episodes. Yeah, I did.
You were the one.
I was the one because, well, apparently Will Ferrell was the other one.
Yeah. And you share something with Will Ferrell.
A birthday.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I share a birthday with Will Ferrell. Anyway, he's going to make Manimal. And apparently the laughs are going to be intentional this time.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Kevin, for letting us know that. Anyway. Getting back to Kevin's letter, Kevin wrote us and said, now that there's a trailer for Hot Tub Time Machine 2, this leads to my science fiction question for Drift Class.
Yes.
Do you have any preferences for how time travel should be handled in fiction, such as you can change the past versus you can't change the past, you can interact with your past self versus you must avoid your past self at all costs? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, Star Trek, the new Star Trek movie kind of cheated on that big time.
A little bit. Well, not really, but okay.
He wants us to talk about time travel, which I love time travel stories.
I do too.
As a historian and as a science fiction.
I have written time travel stories.
You have written time travel stories.
I have published time travel stories.
Yeah.
I have almost published time travel stories.
And you've had time travel stories rejected by publishers.
I have had Harlan Ellison personally commend me on my time travel story and try to help me get it published.
That's really nice.
But which was awesome. Made my entire year. Well, I think getting married made my year.
Yeah, that year was pretty special anyway.
Yeah, but I love time travel stories. And I have lots of favorites. My only rule, really, because writing them is tricky, because you really do have to comb out all the inconsistencies and all the paradoxes, mm-hmm. or you have to allow for them. But you can't do both. So
right.
It's the same rule as any sort of good fiction, as far as I'm concerned, which is you have to be internally consistent to the rules of the genre and the rules you set up at the beginning of the story.
Right, right.
So any time travel story that has to have a little boy roll out of bed and it's all a dream is a bad or Patrick Duffy got out of the shower and suddenly the last season wasn't happening. That cheats.
Yeah.
And if you cheat, I don't care how good the writing was because you've cheated. But stories where you have a deliberate paradox, where you're trapped inside of a time paradox, where you can change the past and have a radical future, which is Sound of Thunder by Ray Bradbury is one of those stories. You step on a butterfly in the Triassic period and you come back and your entire present has changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Versus the idea that time changes to the timeline tend to dampen out over the millennia. So unless you do something really catastrophic, you're not going to have much effect on the present.
Mm-hmm. Well, like Groundhog Day, you have no effect on the present.
Exactly.
You can kill yourself and you wake up the next morning. Right, right.
The idea that the future is immutable and that's
I don't know. Some people might not consider Groundhog Day a time travel story, but it really is.
It really is.
Yeah.
But one thing you have to suspend your disbelief, other than, of course, time traveling over and over again, is that you can carry information from one time loop to the next.
Yep.
That you can learn.
And you can remain constant in the traveling. Right. I find it interesting that some time travel stories focus on how the time travel is accomplished. And there are other movies, I'm thinking particularly of 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
Also Looper.
Yeah.
Where it's just assumed, okay, they can do this.
Right.
And now what happens?
Now let's go with it. And
in a movie like Back to the Future, part of the fun of it is seeing the DeLorean.
Yeah.
And realizing this really crazy person, Doc, has spent his years and years developing this, and they have to find the power source, and that's the whole source of the tension of the movie,
mm-hmm.
Is how are they going to find a power source to power up the time machine? So that's one component that makes a movie very different from another.
Yeah. Terminator throws that away very uh-huh. effectively, which uh-huh. is uh-huh. when asked, how did you get here? His answer is, I don't know tech stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. You're a soldier.
The author of the movie or the director of the movie doesn't care.
Right.
That's not the purpose of the movie.
Right. The narrator doesn't need to know.
Whereas beer is an essential component, obviously, of the hot tub time machine.
Yes, it is.
Lots of alcohol.
And the author of Terminator is not the director of Terminator. The author of Terminator is, of course, Harlan Ellison, from whom the plot was stolen by James Cameron, famously. But as long as you stay consistent to the ground rules you set up, this is why working out the details are really important, because if you're a writer, you can find yourself 4/5 of the way through the story and realize that, holy crap, I painted myself into a corner I can't get out of, which is fun. It's a puzzle. It's like a really good detective story. It should unfold like a puzzle with a good plot.
Yep.
I highly recommend Guns of the South and Bring the Jubilee, which are tampering with time in the Civil War. Two very different stories. But Guns of the South is a deliberate attempt to, and a deliberate successful attempt to alter the course of United States history. But the world is full of awesome time travel stories.
I'm looking at the list that we have in our notes here. We haven't mentioned The Time Machine, which is also a very good movie. Time After Time, which is also H.G. Wells. Is that the one?
I think H.G. Wells is a character. H.G. Wells, Jack the Ripper.
Right. David Warner is Jack the Ripper. You want to talk for a minute? A podcast listener pointed out the movie Primer.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Which you really liked, and I did too.
I did, because it was cheap. It was done for like, $400. It was not really, but it was done really well. You can see how carefully they storyboarded every detail. These guys who were working on a tech project in their garage, literally in the garage, stumble across a side effect to their invention that causes time travel. And they set up a little time machine in a storage locker, and they are going to use it to make money, essentially. And there is several enormous plot twists that you notice 2/3 of the way through the movie that explain things that happened in the first part of the movie. But I admire it because it was diligent about telling the story correctly, taking it seriously. If you're going to make something like that, either be funny, Hot Tub Time Machine, or take your genre seriously.
Right.
But don't change your mind in the middle. And it was done with a great deal of economy. It was done, it's the sort of thing you could imagine people with a digital video camera and a lot of skill making this movie. And it turned out really well. So I can highly recommend Primer. And a personal favorite of mine is Happy Accidents.
Oh, yeah. You showed that one to me. Yeah. You have the video of that somewhere.
I do. It's a wonderful...
It's a romantic comedy.
It is.
Yeah.
It might be a romantic tragedy. We're not really sure. And the proof that this is actually a time travel story, this is one of the fun things of time travel, the proof that it's a time travel story, not just someone having a psychotic episode or making it up. That's the trick. That one little change, that one little detail that makes it definitively, oh, this guy wasn't crazy. He actually was, in fact, describing what was going on. And the fact that you're time traveling makes you an unreliable narrator. It screws you with your head enough so you're not really sure if the person is just nuts or they're telling you what appears to be the truth. And it has some basis in fact. So it's an art. Writing a time travel story is an art. And there's lots of good ones in literature and movies. Even the bad ones, if they're not just incredibly disappointing, can be kind of fun to play with. I'd also recommend The End of Eternity, which is Isaac Asimov. I couldn't find a copy in a bookstore anywhere 15 years ago. I had to check it out from the Harold Washington Library.
Oh, wow.
But it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And Robert Heinlein wrote several of the definitive works of time travel in the science fiction genre. All You Zombies, he wrote a whole bunch of short stories that sort of laid the foundation for the short story time travel genre in science fiction.
You and I had a discussion as to whether The Matrix is a time travel movie.
Yeah, I don't know, because at the end of the day, and I'm not sure how long that I'm very, I was very disappointed they made another movie.
Yes,
Leave it alone, man. like a lot of things, you can kill a good idea with a sequel.
Yeah.
What was it? A friend of mine said, once he found out hippies were at the center of the earth, he just wanted to blow the planet up. really? We want to see a lot of hot, sweaty people dancing. That's nice. That gets your rocks off. But it didn't advance the plot very much.
Doesn't advance the plot, man. But, I think you brought up a point. In answer to Kevin's question, if you don't mind.
Entire reality of the Matrix movies, mm-hmm. all of it, virtually all of it, takes place inside a computer.
Yeah.
Or a series of ever larger computers within computers within computers, and they keep resetting it, then at what point can you consider that a time travel movie, if time is simply an abstract concept that is invented by the program to rerun itself over and over? Somewhere, a timeline is running forward. But within the constructed reality of the Matrix, mm-hmm. How much of that is a repeat and a repeat and a repeat of prior events and making slight changes to that event over and over again, which makes it effectively a time travel story?
Right. And I just wanted to answer Kevin's questions about, is there a preference for how you follow the rules of time travel stories? In my estimation, there isn't.
No.
It just has to work. If you know immediately if it doesn't work,
yeah,
pretty much.
It's like comedy. Is it funny?
Yeah. I mean, there are movies that work. Like Looper, I think, really works.
12 Monkeys really works.
Mm-hmm. Even Hot Tub Time Machine worked. We haven't even talked about frequently asked questions about time travel, which is a funny pub movie, or Time Traveler's Wife, which is another one where that's just sort of a key to the romantic drama that's going on, and it's involuntary.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know, do you consider that science fiction? I guess it has to be.
Oh, yeah. That and the Octavia Butler story on which it was obviously based are certainly time travel stories.
Mm-hmm.
Involuntary time travel, falling back through time, getting stranded in a different era before your own, et cetera, mm-hmm. are all time travel stories.
And you're going to see that in Outlander if you have the right cable channel. We don't. And I watched a little bit of the beginning of Outlander. It was free online.
Uh-huh.
And I was personally bored with it the first 10 minutes. So.
Well, I think if there's nothing at stake in a science fiction story, if it's not mm-hmm. telling a story about what it means to be human, mm-hmm. what it means to be civilized, what it means, you know, if it's not making some social commentary of some kind,
mm-hmm.
then it's just a gadget story, which is going to be kind of interesting.
Or a historical fiction story, which you're just telling through modernized by having a modern person beep into the timeline.
But something has to be at stake, and something has to be. And usually you're getting a window on some problem or interesting facet of human nature the author wants to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the only way to do that is through the lens of science fiction.
Well, and I think, for instance, you know, an example that everyone or many people would have watched in talking about Hot Tub Time Machine. You know, would Hot Tub Time Machine have actually worked if the Rob Corddry character wasn't interested in killing himself?
Yeah, exactly. No.
You know, no.
No, it wouldn't have.
That was what was at stake, was his future.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, and if you go back all the way to the Gene Roddenberry rewrite of the Harlan Ellison script for City on the Edge of Forever in Star Trek, which it's arguably the best episode of the original Star Trek period.
Mm-hmm.
But the stakes are very high.
Yeah.
And what you have is a existential conflict between love and duty. How much are you willing to sacrifice for the woman you love? That's the story. And everything else is interesting and gadget-driven and fascinating, but that's the real story. And if you get an author who understands, if you don't have a human heart going inside this machine, nobody cares. Once you have that locked into place, then worry about the details of whether or not it's an existential tragedy. Nothing can be changed. You're fucked and you're doomed. And you realize that you're stuck. It's like 1984 is that way in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
The end of the story is hopeless. It's an existential tragedy. You're trapped in a system that can never change. Or you can change something, but put a human being at the center of your plot and you'll do okay.
Thank you very much, Driftglass. And thank you, Kevin.
You bet.
Send in your science fiction questions or trivia to Mrs. Driftglass, mrs.driftglass@gmail.com.
And I will not read them.
Thank
Unless
you.
They're no, questions like this, in which case.
Yeah, I do. If you ask some big philosophical question where you want Driftglass to list stories or movies, then I forward that on to him in advance so he can make a list.
And my caveat here is I'm sure I missed a whole bunch of stuff.
And let us know.
Yeah.
Let us know. Hey, listen, Jagoffs, you forgot that one. Yeah,
you forgot Time Bandits, dumbass.
Well, yeah. All right.
Got it.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks, guys.